It's time for the Plan Strong Financial Forum, your weekly hot topic update from a leading Boston area investment advisor. It's smart investing simplified. Now here's your host, Ken Carberry, with the president of Plan Strong Investment Management, Paul Parson.
And welcome to the Plan Strong Financial Forum. I'm your host, attorney Ken Carberry, along with financial advisor Paul Parsons. And Paul, what a wild couple of weeks in the market, huh?
You think?
I mean, the market is continuing to recover from that fit it had last week.
Fit is a tizzy fit, is what it? I like to call it. Yes.
We're up again north of 5,500.
Yeah, for the S&P.
Yeah, for the S&P.
Right.
Wow. What's going on? I suppose we're going to talk about this today.
Affirmative.
Yeah, okay,
yes, good. Yes, we are. We're definitely going to cover that. And I certainly want to talk about some of the data that I think is reversing that trend. Because, mm-hmm. you know, let's face it, that whole thing was caused by the market freaking out over the first thing was the jobs report.
Right.
Oh, they only added 100,000 jobs during the last month. Mm-hmm. And then the corollary to that was that's the first sign that we're really seeing the economy to slow. And it's the next shoe to drop is that the economy is going to be in recession. And then they started to, on top of that, compound a bunch of other things, as I said last week, including, you know, the whole thing with the Japanese carry trade and all kinds of other stuff that happened at the same time. Right. Warren Buffett selling Apple stock, you know, two right. quarters prior, but somehow it became incredibly important that day and so forth. So whole bunch of reasons for that. But this week, we got some updated inflation data and updated retail sales data. Mm. And that stuff counts because... Right. The market wants to know, is the Fed going to lower interest rates anytime soon? They've been waiting for a long time, and they've been betting on it happening for a long time. And here we are coming up to the September Fed meeting. We're running out of months.
Okay? Yes, we are.
And so they'd like to see the overnight borrowing rate actually come down at some point yeah. in their lifetime. And so the question is the data going to support that, and is it going to support it for the right reasons? Mm-hmm. Okay. In other words, inflation's coming down, but the economy's not tanking at the same time. Okay, so
all right.
that's the first thing I want to talk about. Then you did bring it up. Here
yes.
we are a week later. How worried should we be about this market? And a lot of people yeah. say, why are they even bringing this up? We're all set. Everything's back, you know? Well, it's almost back. Mm-hmm. We're about 3% below the all-time high hit on July 16th for the S&P 500. And that was around, you know, north of 5,600. I think it was 5,667 or something. And, you know, here we are just north of 5,500. But the question is, when you saw how much the market had dropped between mid-July till early August, and then with that little emphasis that first couple of days of August, you know, a lot of people were saying, is this the beginning of the end?
Sure. Yeah.
Jeremy Siegel, the professor from Wharton, was getting out there and saying, hey, we need an emergency rate cut of not just one, not just two, but 3.25% rate cut. So down 75 basis points or 0.75%. We need to do it immediately.
Right.
And, well, a week later, Emily Luttrell is probably in the wings saying, never mind, because, you know, that didn't turn out to be
right.
truth at all. But anyway, there are a number of things written about how worried should we be about this market. And the answer is some. Okay. And I want to talk about why. And it's frankly, it's not that different from what we've been saying all along.
Mm-hmm.
It's
mm-hmm.
just that the market had the vapors and then caught itself.
Right.
And what I want to do is say, well, as a rational investor, what should you make of that?
Mm-hmm.
And then... Another thing I wanted to hit Kenny this week was bond markets. We didn't talk about bond markets at all, but we talked about how the stock market reacted to some of this data. And what I wanted to point out was a very, very important thing for how the bond markets reacted to this, because did interest rates go down suddenly at the beginning of August in response to this? In other words, did people get out of stocks and buy bonds? And the answer is yeah. Okay. But that's not what really tells you whether or not an economic recession is coming or there's a real concern for economic recession. There's another metric that bond managers look at that's much more important as it relates to saying whether or not the economy is going to go into recession or not.
Mm-hmm.
And I have to tell you, that indicator didn't reflect the same thing. It continues to not reflect that same thing. And
all
so
right.
kind of good news there.
Yeah.
And then overall, you know, we are in earnings season.
Yes. Right.
And we're just finishing earnings season. I think they've got 90% of the S&P 500 earnings done by this point, right? And the question is, what have we learned so far during earnings season? In other words, what were some of the key themes that we heard in these earnings calls and in the commentaries and, you know, the beats and the misses and all that? What did we get out of all that? Because, again, we're looking for clues as to, are we going to make these earnings growth numbers? Okay, yes or no? And how's it look going forward? Because these are ambitious plans that the market has priced in. So I want to hit that. Then, as I said last week, Lilly had some good news. And I want to cover that because not only they have one good piece of news, but they had two good pieces of news. And as a result, their stock was up big on that. And then with time, I'd like to talk about people keep buying annuities, and the question is, should they? And then another thing is, we have one longer-term economic trend that investors should worry about. I want to hit that as well.
All right, Paul, so let's not bury the lead story here, which is, in this case, the key data released this week, including inflation and retail sales numbers that people are really paying attention to. So how did it look?
So consumer and producer price increases for July were reported this week. And I got to tell you, a lot of people were focused on this data because the market essentially has already assumed that inflation is declining back towards the Fed's target. It's called disinflation, right? And a further decline would reinforce that notion that we're going in the right direction and eventually we're going to get to the right neighborhood here. And it also supports the expected interest rate cuts in September, November, and December that are already priced in to the interest rate markets futures. Okay, so, and by the way, what are priced in right now is one rate cut in September, two in November, and one in December. Okay. So a total of one full percentage between now and the end of the year. So going from 5.25 to 5.5 to 4.25 to 4.5 over the next 3 or 4 months.
Okay.
So pretty substantial. Yeah, and why is that? Because the market's counting on the Fed saying, hey, inflation's under control enough that we're okay to do that. Okay. And a bounce back in inflation would seriously raise the specter of stagflation. And what that would mean is slowing economic growth amidst high interest rates. And that's not a good answer. Okay, so that's what the market's worried about. So let's talk about what the results were. First of all, the most important metric, which is the consumer price index, and specifically the core consumer price index, rose 0.2% month over month in July. It was up from 0.1% month over month in June. But on a year over year level, it actually declined a little bit from 3.3% down to 3.2% in July. So you'd say, well, it's disinflation, at least on a year over year basis, but is it really in the 2% neighborhood? Not especially.
Oh, really?
Right?
Okay.
It's going down slowly.
Okay.
And actually, on a month over month basis, it accelerated a little bit. So I would say kind of, not great news, but not terrible. And then if you say, well, how about headline CPI? So this includes energy and food and everything that people really care about, in addition to the core, less volatile items. Headline CPI slightly declined as well, going from 3% to 2.9% year over year. So disinflation, but is it 2? No, it's 2.9.
Okay.
And by the way, a big part of that was energy, which we know goes down as well as goes up. This month, it went down a lot, and that's what fed that a lot. Now, what was interesting to me, Kenny, just as an aside, do you see how the Wall Street Journal covered this on the front page?
Yes.
Kind of interesting, right? Now, if I could think to myself, and I just love to look at how different things are covered in the front of the journal versus the back of the journal, because the front of the journal is more liberal and the back of the journal is more conservative. And the way they covered the fact that headline inflation went from 3% to 2.9% was they said inflation hits lowest level since 2021. And I thought to myself, okay, that's like saying, you know, my kid has gone from a C minus to a C. It's the best grade he's gotten, you know, in 3 years.
Right.
It's still a C, right? It's not an A. It's not a B. It's a C. And that's where we are. And yet, you know, they're declaring victory with that. And again, it seems a little bit of a cheerleading piece for the current administration. It certainly reinforces that thinking that the front of the journal tends to be a bit more liberal, the back or the editorial page tends to be a bit more conservative. Anyway, if you look at what's underneath that inflation, this is really what's a little bit concerning, and that is shelter and core services. We've talked about core services inflation in the past. That essentially is labor costs in services, okay? And guess what? It continues to fuel higher than desired inflation. So shelter and labor. Well, those are two pretty important things. And so, you know, if you look at that, it really reinforces this problem with labor costs and likely gives fodder to the hawks at the Fed to probably press ahead with only one rate decrease in September, not two, because they just haven't fixed services inflation nor shelter inflation yet. Okay. And then if you look at producer prices, this is the other piece of data we got for July. They were flat month over month. So essentially no inflation on a monthly basis. That's good news. They were up 2.4% year over year, and that was down from 3% in June. So that's meaningful. And also at the headline level, they were down in a similar manner, and they're down about to a year over year basis of about 2.2%. So producer prices are getting much closer to the Fed's target of 2%. Consumer prices, the end prices, continue to be a bit higher than, frankly, where we'd want to see them, and frankly, where the Fed would like to see them. Is disinflation happening? Yes. But are we at the target yet? No. And are we getting there quickly? No.
When we come back, Paul, we'll talk more about inflation, and then we'll look at what happened to the market last week and how the bond market has reacted. That's when we return. It's the Plan Strong Financial Forum.
This is Paul Parsons, president of Plan Strong Investment Management, and you're listening to the Plan Strong Financial Forum. If you like what you hear on our show and want me to take a look at your investments and retirement plan, call my office at 888-972-7526, 888-972-7526. That's 888-972-PLAN. Or go to planstrong.com.
Securities and advisory services offered through Commonwealth Financial Network, member FINRA, SIPC. A registered investment advisor, 980 Washington Street, Dedham, Mass.
From the Plan Strong broadcast studios at the epicenter of capitalism, this is the Plan Strong Financial Forum with Paul Parsons, president of Plan Strong Investment Management.
And welcome back to the Plan Strong Financial Forum. I'm your host, attorney Ken Carberry, along with financial advisor Paul Parsons. And Paul, we've now said goodbye to the Olympics. It's been over now for about a week.
Yeah.
And
Paralympics are coming, right?
Paralympics coming. Yeah. Overall, what do you think of the experience?
You know what? I enjoyed it a lot more than I thought I was going to. And I kind of got the feel-good thing. I think Paris is such a beautiful city that it's easy to say, you know, the people, whether they're running the marathon or riding a bike through it, or they're playing volleyball under the Eiffel Tower or whatever.
It's like pretty cool venues.
Okay, pretty, not bad.
You're right, Paul. Not bad at all. Did you watch any of the gold medal winning basketball team?
I did. I actually watched the whole game.
Did you
know
what?
I did. Well, most of it. Yeah. And I thought it was, you know, my only thing was, and I was sitting with a couple other guys at our house on Cape Cod, and we were watching the officiating. Did you notice the officiating at all?
Of course.
So it was the United States against France, and it happened to be held in France.
In France,
So kind of, you know, we're a hockey family.
Yeah.
So it kind of reminded me of whenever we'd go to Canada for a game,
right,
you were always down a couple of goals before you got on the ice, and your best player was going to be in the penalty box for a good part of the game, right? And that was kind of like what the officiating reminded me of it a little bit. And I'm sure I'm slanted, but there was one call, and I can't remember who it was. It was a guard. Maybe it was Holiday. Somebody was making a move just to literally get out of a zone and kind of steer clear. And this French guy literally jumped in front of him. Both his feet, neither of his feet were on the ground at the time there was contact made. And they called the United States player for the charge, which I always thought they had to have position to be able to be charged against. But you're learning new rules every day, right? What did you think of Steph Curry?
Well, obviously, he did prove to be one of the great shooters of all time.
What a clinic.
Yeah.
I mean,
no doubt.
And the guy was on fire. Yeah. I mean, he could have closed his eyes, thrown it up over his head, and it would have gone in, I think, right?
Oh, sure. No, absolutely. I'm angry as a Celtics fan that Jason Tatum spent most of the time on the bench. It makes absolutely no sense.
It was a little weird.
He's certainly one of the best players in the world and deserved to be in there. Why bring him over to have him sit on the bench?
Don't know.
While you're playing two of people on his team who, you know, would be second, third or fourth options after him.
Right.
You're playing them in front of him. It was odd. I have to imagine that.
He handled it well, though, didn't he?
He handled it very professionally. Yeah. He always does. I have to imagine that either Kerr doesn't like him or doesn't like Celtics. Or, I suppose.
Probably a little bit of both.
Yeah.
So, well, the good news is they won. And yeah. It wasn't that tight a game at the end, right. Which is good, because if it had been, it would have been big trouble.
Exactly.
But anyway, a lot of fun to watch. So I really enjoyed that. And you know what? Why don't we go back to the inflation stuff?
Yeah.
Okay?
Can we go back to gold medal talk instead of inflation talk?
No. Okay, so. Now, actually, right. The inflation data, as I said, it did show disinflation.
Right.
Just not great disinflation, right? And so it really kind of reinforced the idea of not a lot of rate cuts, but maybe, okay, it didn't stop the first rate cut from happening in September, but it certainly didn't pour, you know, gas on the fire to do more than one rate cut in September. So that's my take from that.
Because people are seeing the newspaper headlines. You mentioned the Journal. And really most of the newspapers are and on TV.
Lowest since 21.
Exactly. It's a big deal.
Except it's still at, you know, 2.9% or, you know, whatever it is. And that's just too high. Okay. So anyway, while those inflation metrics are important, we also got retail sales for the month of July. And frankly, this was very important to me because it's a reflection of the continued health of the U.S. consumer and economic growth overall.
Mm-hmm.
And I got to tell you, at the headline level, it was pretty good. Retail sales were up big, up 1% month over month. That's much more than expected, but after a negatively revised month of June. Now, if you exclude the large dollar purchases of automobiles, retail sales were up 0.4% in July versus 0.5% in June. Still, those are very healthy numbers. You know, think it went from 6% growth on an annualized basis to 4.8%. That's still really, really good growth, okay? And the headline growth was fueled by car sales after the adverse effects of the cyber attack on them in June. Remember how we talked about that? And they didn't sell as many cars in June, so there was this backlog of cars that all got sold in July. But after you look past that, there was really good gains in a variety of other goods and services as well. And what that did, it signaled good consumer strength. Okay.
So how would you wrap this up for us, Paul?
First, disinflation continues slowly towards target, but labor and shelter costs remain sticky. Retail sales pointed to economic growth, not contraction. Essentially, I'd say just kind of more of the same. Stubbornly elevated inflation, receding more slowly than the Fed would like, but an economy that continues to defy recession concerns. Essentially, good but not great news for investors.
Of course, Paul, the other big story on the investing front, aside from inflation, is we're only a week or so after this. The mini nervous breakdown that the market went through just last week.
Yeah.
So how worried should folks be about this market?
So the Sevens Report, which is one of the services that I subscribe to, had a good article on the topic that I thought would be helpful to share with the listeners on this one. It pointed out that there was a big surge in volatility in the prior week. In fact, it was the biggest surge in volatility of all of 2024. And that's because investors were confronted with a number of potential negatives that included economic growth concerns, an unwind of the yen carry trade, and a reversal of extreme overweight positions in both technology and artificial intelligence names.
Mm-hmm.
And in spite of all of the volatility, the S&P 500 started and ended the week at almost exactly the same level, 5340. Okay?
Amazing, yeah.
And the Magnificent Seven stocks finished within a point or two of break even for the week, except for Meta, which was up a lot.
Wow.
Okay? So when you think about the commentary at the beginning of the week of, is this the beginning of the end? And, you know, batting down the hatches and all kind. The week ended up much better than I think people thought at the beginning of the week. Now, following that week of recovery, many analysts characterized the recent volatility as a typical pullback in an upward trending market. Essentially, they were pretty dismissive of the volatility. But the Sevens reminds us that there are serious changes potentially happening to the U.S. economy and markets. And if they do go bad, they could end the bull market run. So let's talk about what those concerns are that could get in the way.
All right.
First, some economic indicators point to slowing growth or even outright contraction. Now, we're getting mixed economic growth data from the Flash PMIs, the Purchasing Manager Index numbers. The labor market seems to finally be reflecting some excess capacity, some softness. And on the other hand, this week we got strong retail sales. Mm-hmm. So you got, you know, good and bad. And the question is, if soft economic data gets softer, it could be a potential major threat to the market. Are we seeing that yet? No. But could it happen? Sure. The labor market is softening up. Second thing they're worried about is the recent surge in the strength of the yen. That revealed a serious overcrowding in the yen carry trade. I explained what that was last week. And as it unwinds, it will cause more volatility. There is likely more dollar selling to come as the Japanese central bank moves to raise rates and strengthen their currency, while the U.S. is on the cusp of lowering rates and, as a result, weakening a demand for the dollar. And that likely means less demand and thus lower prices for U.S. stocks and bonds. So that's going in the wrong direction for the market.
Sure.
Okay.
Okay. And you've got another concern for us?
How about overweights in tech and artificial intelligence names? The good news is those overweights have been reduced, but much of this rally this year has been driven by the Magnificent Seven gains. And if more artificial intelligence and tech firms offer mixed guidance, like, for example, ASML did last week, or Amazon or Google and Tesla did, and, and what we're really going to be looking forward to is NVIDIA when they report not only their results, but also their forward guidance on August 28th. If we see them say, we're a little bit worried going forward, we may not get quite the kind of growth we were counting on. Well, we may see tech decline further, and it would likely drag down more of the market with it. We've said it all along. This market is counting on earnings growth, and these firms are expected to be the outsized contributors to that growth. Any deterioration in that outlook should directly impact the market overall.
All right. Any other concerns?
There is one other concern that I bring up early and often, and that is that valuations are high, even after the market pulled back a bit from all-time highs hit in July 16th. The S&P 500 right now is trading a bit over between 19 and 20 times forward earnings of and when I say forward, all of 2025 expected earnings of $275 a share. Now, while that's down from almost 22 times forward earnings, and that's what we hit, you know, back in mid-July, it's still way above a more rational multiple of, say, 18 times forward earnings, assuming interest rates decline to near target while the economy is slowing somewhat. Taking that same $275 a share, multiply it by the 18 multiple, you get just under $5,000. That's, you know, that's 8 to 10% below current levels, Kenny. It's not above them. That means the market is already looking ahead to 2026 earnings, or a multiple more consistent with a rapidly growing economy. Okay?
All right.
So what do these guys all conclude? There are substantial risks to this market, and they're becoming more likely, not less, as time goes by. They don't recommend going fully risk off or just selling your stocks, but they do advocate for a more defensive posture with lower volatility investments.
Paul, when we come back, we'll talk about the bond market, which we haven't really talked about much in the last couple of weeks because the stock market has been taking up all of our time. But obviously, there had to be some reaction from the folks on the bond side looking at what's going on in the stock side. So we'll address that when we return. It's the Plan Strong Financial Forum.
This is Paul Parsons, president of Plan Strong Investment Management, and you're listening to the Plan Strong Financial Forum. If you like what you hear on our show and want me to take a look at your investments and retirement plan, call my office at 888-972-7526, 888-972-7526. That's 888-972-PLAN. Or go to PlanStrong.com.
Securities and advisory services offered through Commonwealth Financial Network, member FINRA, SIPC. A registered investment advisor, 980 Washington Street, Dedham, Mass.
Who says financial talk can't be exciting and informative? Well, at least it's informative. It's the Plan Strong Financial Forum with Paul Parsons, president of Plan Strong Investment Management.
And welcome back to the Plan Strong Financial Forum. I'm your host, attorney Ken Carberry, along with financial advisor Paul Parsons. And Paul, we are quickly approaching a wild election season.
Boy, is that a fact. Starting with the, the Democratic Convention starts,
right.
The 19th?
When is
that?
Right up, right, next week.
This coming week, right? So that's obviously a big deal. Be interesting how that comes off in Chicago.
Yeah.
You know?
Oh, yeah.
I still remember 1968. I don't know about you, but that was not good.
That was the last time they were in Chicago. Right?
And they don't have Richard Daley as the mayor anymore either. Right? And he used an iron fist to, keep things down.
I remember,
You know, and there were young men worried about going off to war then.
Right.
So that was
very different.
That was not a good situation.
Right.
But now I think the Democrats are going to have their hands full trying to keep a rosy picture on the whole thing out there. But we'll see what happens. So anyway, but I actually, now that we're talking about that, I really did think I was losing my mind this week. And I had to kind of share this with you.
Sure.
Because you saw that Vice President Kamala Harris proposed eliminating taxes on tips.
Correct. Yes.
But, you know, I've read about this for years and years and years. There was a guy named Bernard Goldberg, who was a famous reporter who wrote one of the first books on the way the media would cover one party versus the other, about bias in the media. And when he wrote this book, it was very contentious that there was any bias in the media. And he actually provided example after example. Well, we got one in living color last week because I remembered that when Trump proposed eliminating taxes on tips, the whole state-run media marched in lockstep, covering it from the angle of how it would be paid for or how much it would add to the deficit and the debt. And then when you looked at when Kamala Harris proposed it, the exact same media outlets reported in the context of Harris fighting to end taxes on tips. That was it. No mention of how it's going to be paid for or, you know, debt or deficit or not a word about that. Just she's fighting for you. And, you know, this is the same media that never worries about deficits or debt when the Inflation Reduction Act was proposed by the Biden White House, but always mention the deficit and debt implications of continuing the Trump tax cuts.
Right.
And I just sit there and say, okay, I get it. And you know, they never mention that Harris placed the deciding vote as president of the Senate to pass the Inflation Reduction Act in 2022. And you know what was in there? There is a provision for the IRS to track down workers' tips so that they could be taxed.
Yeah, well, maybe she's had a change of heart.
Evolved.
It's an evolution.
I think she's evolved on the subject.
In a couple of years.
You know, and my favorite part of all of it was, in the end, there was some soul-searching by, again, the state-run media, where they seemed concerned with whether Trump was accurate when he accused Harris of stealing his idea. Because the question was, well, was it really her idea before, but she hadn't enunciated it until now.
Okay.
So all I can tell you is I really feel like I live in like Alice in Wonderland. And
I,
you know what?
I'm
saying this purely from the perspective of somebody that just looks at stuff and says, can we just, you know, be fair, somewhat fair in any way, shape or form? And hopefully, you know, candid. So anyway, with that in mind, let me be fair and candid with how I talk about the mini nervous breakdown and how the bond market handled
that. We have not had a chance to talk about the bond market at all because there's been so much going on
the stock side.
On the stock side. Yeah. So what does it mean? How did they react? Did they react? And what might it mean for investors?
So the answer is yes and no.
Okay.
It did react and it didn't react. And that's the really, really interesting thing here. Because
Explain.
The U.S. stock market saw volatility explode right at the beginning of last week. And we saw this flight to safety in the bond market. So in other words, people sold stocks and bought bonds.
Okay.
And what does that do? Well, it resulted in price increases for bonds. And as a result, the yields came down on those bonds.
Mm-hmm.
So yields on the 2 and the 10-year treasuries were the lowest they had been all year. They dropped a lot, Kenny. They dropped about 0.4% on a yield. That's a lot in a day or two.
Sure.
Okay. And since that time, there's been a modest rebound from those yield lows, but not nearly the recovery to, if you will, pre-crash levels. And this move in yields likely reflects the market's increased expectations of Fed rate cuts. It also takes off the table any possibility of a Fed rate hike, signifying really a tailwind for bonds instead of the headwind that bond investors have faced in a rising interest rate environment for the last 2.5 years. Okay. So while there was this rush of safety to bonds, there wasn't a substantial increase in credit spreads. And I'll explain what that means in a minute. And that is really important because the debt market is often thought of as providing a more grounded view of economic prospects. So for all of 2024, we have seen the spreads or the differences between the yields on U.S. Treasuries and all qualities of bonds decrease to some of the lowest levels in the last 25 years. Typically, when the spreads are tight, that means that investors aren't requiring a lot more payoff to take the extra credit risk compared to the relative certainty of getting paid back by the government. And that implies confidence in the economic environment. So, how did the bond market spreads react to the concerns that sent the stock market going nuts in early August? They moved up slightly on August 5th, but they've retrenched to almost exactly the same level that they were before that day. It is true that spreads on the lowest rated debt were increasing before last week, and that suggests that higher for longer borrowing costs are actually hurting the most leveraged firms, the ones that have the lowest bond ratings. But most of the bond market has remained surprisingly robust, except perhaps for that riskiest debt that may be fraying just a little bit around the edges. And that means for most companies, the reason that the credit spreads haven't gotten bigger is because they have ample cash buffers and strong investor appetite to get a pickup over treasury yields that corporates offer. And that seems to be enough of a pickoff to ward off any dangers. Mm-hmm. Okay, so it looks like the bond market adjusted for an increased likelihood of Fed rate cuts. And we saw that with the yields going down overall. But at the same time, it doesn't yet see a big risk of a recession, because if we did see that, we would see credit spreads increase. We didn't see that. People would demand more payout, more yield for a riskier bond. They didn't do that. And equity holders should recognize this, because bond traders have a penchant for being pessimistic. Mm-hmm. Okay. So, by the way, one other note, since rates have come down in the last month, the entire range of treasury maturities are now in the black for total return year to date, up 1.5% to 3.5% for that period. That's much more in line with bond returns of 2023, and certainly a far cry from the disaster of 2022.
Sure. All right, Paul, of course, we always like to cover earnings, because that's a very important part. We look at what's happening with the economy and what might happen with interest rates. So here we are. We've got just about all of the earnings in now.
We have
all the earnings
yep.
reports in. We're wrapping up earnings season. So what have we learned?
Sure. So the journal addressed what we've learned thus far from earnings season with five key observations. Okay. I thought I'd hit those.
Sure.
Okay. First one, profits, they look strong, and they're even better than what analysts expected at the beginning of earnings season. Here's the problem. Revenues are underperforming, suggesting that profit beats are occurring due to cost cutting and other one-time kind of non-repeatable gains. So yeah, you're beating on the profit thing, but are you doing it on a sustained basis?
Mm-hmm.
Not necessarily.
Right.
And are revenues what they should be? Is the business growing as much as you think it should be? Not quite as much. Okay. Second thing, revenue shortfalls are occurring in some companies where lower income, mass market customers are cutting back on little things like fast food and snacks. High-end shoppers are economizing as well, with aspirational and even ultra-wealthy shoppers taking a little bit of a breather from buying high-end or luxury items. So that's the third thing we've learned out of this earnings season. So it's not just there's less demand for the lower-end stuff, mm-hmm. but even on the higher-end stuff, people are taking a little bit of a breather. A fourth thing we're learning is that high interest rates are weighing on banks' profitabilities. Why? Banks are being forced to offer higher yields to prevent customers from taking their deposits elsewhere to make a better return. Higher rates also lead to fewer mortgage originations or refinances, while credit card holders are falling behind on bills at the same time. Now, to offset that to a degree, we are seeing investment banking and trading revenue is actually doing better than expected. And that's only happening, of course, at those banks that offer those services. Mm-hmm. So that's not all the banks, right? And then the fifth thing we're learning is that big tech continues to spend tons of money. So this is the Googles and Apples and Metas. They continue to spend tons of money on AI investments. That hurts their shorter-term profitability because they're not paying out as a profit. Instead, they're investing it. They're buying additional equipment. And the question is whether they will be rewarded with lots of incremental business from that investment. And because they're not sure of that, it feeds uncertainty.
Sure.
Okay?
How would you wrap that up for us, Paul?
Well, overall, according to FactSet, the S&P 500 continues to be on track to deliver about 11% earnings growth for all of 2024 to end the year at around $241 a share. And the current reporting quarter, Q2, looks like earnings will come in at $60 a share, up from the $59 forecast at the beginning of the period, and up from $54 a share in Q2 a year ago, and $56 a share this last quarter, Q1 of 24. So it's up, it's $60, it's better than $54 or $56. But there are risks, and investors should be aware of them and position their portfolio appropriately.
All right, Paul, when we come back, we'll ask that big question about annuities. People seem to keep buying them. Should they? We'll talk about that when we return. It's the Plan Strong Financial Forum.
This is Paul Parsons, president of Plan Strong Investment Management, and you're listening to the Plan Strong Financial Forum. If you like what you hear on our show and want me to take a look at your investments and retirement plan, call my office at 888-972-7526, 888-972-7526. That's 888-972-PLAN. Or go to planstrong.com.
Securities and advisory services offered through Commonwealth Financial Network, member FINRA, SIPC. A registered investment advisor, 980 Washington Street, Dedham, Mass.
Finally, a radio show that is not trying to sell you insurance or annuities. This is the Plan Strong Financial Forum with Paul Parsons, president of Plan Strong Investment Management.
And welcome back to the Plan Strong Financial Forum. I'm your host, attorney Ken Carberry, along with financial advisor Paul Parsons. Paul, we were talking about the election coming up in the last segment.
Right.
And you mentioned you had another story you wanted to cover having to do with our vice president.
Well, I'm kind of glad they're doing the Democrat National Convention this upcoming week, simply because we haven't heard anything from, I guess, their nominee. I mean, she wasn't the nominee until Biden was forced out. And now I guess she is the nominee.
Well, she has to be nominated, I guess. They'll do that at the convention.
I don't know. I don't know if there's been a secret vote already taken because they talked about that as well. I have no idea. Mm. But the good news is she will, I hope, speak at the Democrat National Convention, right?
So, yeah.
And I have to tell you, it's not just my frustration that's showing through. Here's how bad it is. Mm-hmm. When Jim Acosta, remember how much he hated Trump?
It was
personal. Jim Acosta actually asked one of the campaign people at the Kamala Harris campaign, you know, if it would be asking too much for her to do a press conference. And this is, you know, 3 weeks plus after she's become the nominee. Mm. And she hasn't done one, you know, question and answer session with anyone.
Right, right.
So when you get CNN taking that perspective, probably showing a pretty big weakness at that mm-hmm. point. Maybe it's a good idea. On the other hand, maybe I understand it because a little bit of her economic plan got leaked out this week. And I guess the thing I heard about was this proposal for the first ever ban on price gouging on food and groceries, setting clear rules on the road to make clear that big corporations can't unfairly exploit consumers to run up excessive corporate profits on food and groceries. You know the one thing that hits me about this?
What?
Do you know what one of the worst businesses in the free world is that makes no profit?
No.
food and groceries.
Oh, really? Yeah. Just very, well, grocery stores, true, very small margins, very small.
Paper-thin margins, right? So when you think, oh, these are the barons, the robber barons, I don't think so. Yeah. You know, the guy who runs whatever the biggest grocery stores in the United States is not the same guy that's running NVIDIA with their 50% margins making billions and billions of dollars, right?
True.
Okay? So you say to yourself, wait a minute, what? And then the other thing that came to my mind immediately was, we actually hosted a young lady from Ukraine. We've talked about this several times. She grew up in Kharkiv and was a hockey player, ultimately went to Harvard to play hockey there. And she was absolutely marveled at our grocery stores because she'd walk into a grocery store and the shelves would all be full.
Sure.
And she'd say, is like a political official coming? And we'd say, why do you ask that? And she said, because all the shelves are full. And we say, well, what's it like at home? She goes, oh, no, they're empty unless a political official's coming through. And it was like, why is that? She goes, well, because we have price controls. And if you have price controls, then people just don't make it because they can't make money at it. So they say, forget it, I won't make it. So the good news is you have a price control. The bad news is it's so scarce, nobody can have it. Anyway, I really hope that maybe that's why we haven't heard that much about their policies yet, because the policies may be able to have some shots fired at them.
Yeah,
we'll
see.
Good point.
I'm sure we'll see. I expect we'll hear much of that this week.
I hope so. I'd like to learn more about whatever the platform is.
So, Paul, how about a little to good news? We do for a little good news. You did say you had one good story.
At least one. But Lily has to be towards the top of the list. And at first it was reported that their active ingredient in their Mounjaro and Zepbound weight loss drugs leads to even more weight loss than Novo Nordisk's Ozempic and Wegovy. So that's great news.
It's
right?
great. It reminds me, it's like when you go for a job interview and they ask for, you know, what's your weakness? I work too hard.
Right.
Yeah. What's the problem with the drug? It works too well.
It works better than the other guy. Yeah. And in fact, new research that was published in the Journal of the American Medical Association, their internal medicine document reported that patients taking the highest dose of Zepbound lost about 21% of their body weight, while those on Novo's Wegovy lost about 15% after 68 weeks. Mm-hmm. So 21 versus 15, pretty darn good, right?
Yeah.
And there were no difference in side effects. Hmm. And, you know, when you look at that, you say, okay, that's really good news for them. But then later, we learn that they got their Q2 revenues and earnings numbers, which, when I say trounced investor expectations, trounced isn't a good enough word.
Wow.
It doesn't do a justification, okay? Because the robust sales of Zepbound just knocked it out of the park. The company actually increased revenue guidance for future periods as well. And when I say that they trounced their targets, I mean, they were reported earnings of just under $4 a share, 70% higher than analysts expected at $2.75 a share.
Wow.
The stock was up 10% on the day of the earnings announcement. It's up 70% year to date. It's still a bit below its all-time high in mid-July. And it's trading at nearly 50 times next 12 months earnings. But don't forget, earnings are really expected to grow a lot. They're expected to double in 2024, increase another 40% in 2025. And margins have improved from 15% to 29% between 23 and 24. So they're growing, their profits getting bigger, and their margins, their percentage margins are getting bigger. Other than that, things are going terribly, okay? and this is really one great business going after a great mega trend. Now, the good news is investors should feel good about that. But the problem with any great business like that is it's going to attract competitors.
Sure.
And it sure has. And as a result, I would say investors should be wary of competitors that may be able to go after at least some of Lilly's market share as a result.
Paul, I'm glad we have a few more minutes to talk about annuities. We get a lot of questions about annuities. I know you do.
Uh-huh.
People who know I do this program ask me a lot about annuities. I always say, ask Paul.
Thank you.
And the thing is, too, although you often will say, hey, we're not annuity people here, but sometimes you will say there are times when it could work. So you've been very fair, I think, when discussing
Try
annuities.
To be. Yep.
So I think annuities seem, I hear a lot about them these days. It seems like they're still a thing.
They are, very much so.
So should they be right now in this economy?
So it's funny because Barron's had their annual annuity article, and it talked about the best 100 annuities in their opinion. And they reviewed a number of kinds of annuities, and in the end, frankly, it may be difficult for readers to determine if an annuity has some role to play in their circumstances as a result. It's a complicated topic. That's all I can say to you. As we've said in the past, we are concerned that annuities are overprescribed to retail investors by insurance salespeople who often have extensive lucrative incentives to sell them to the public. And any incentive they receive, don't forget, comes at the expense of the financial return for the person who buys the annuity.
Sure.
They're funding it, okay? So, first of all, you asked, are they still hot? The answer is, yeah, annuity sales are at a record high, and people continue to buy them. But the question is, should they continue to buy them? And the answer is, they may be appropriate for some people for a portion of their portfolio. But individual goals and circumstances are critical to determining if one may play a role in your overall financial strategy. So to start out this discussion in today's show, let's just walk through how one of the simplest annuities available work, and they may or may not be appropriate for, what circumstances they may or may not be appropriate for. In other shows, we can discuss some more complicated annuities because it's a long list.
Right.
Let's start with a simple one called a deferred income annuity. It's one of the simplest ones around. You pay a premium now. You give them some money, and you agree to start to receive payments at some point in the future for a period certain, or your lifetime, or both. So, in other words, deferred income annuity.
Okay.
Deferred because you pay now, but you don't start to take the income until some point in the future.
Got it.
Okay?
Mm-hmm.
Deferred income annuity. So, let's take an example. You're 60 years old. You invest $200,000 in a deferred income annuity that pays you guaranteed income for life starting at age 70. So you give them money now, 10 years later, they're going to start to pay you out.
Gotcha.
Okay? The best rate quoted provided annual income of approximately $30,000 a year for a male, $28,000 a year for a female. It may sound good, right?
Mm-hmm.
Until you do the math and you understand that it would take 17 to 18 years just to get your principal back.
Really?
Okay.
So
now,
you'd be 88.
Yes, exactly.
Yeah.
Okay.
Okay.
So you say,
I did that
math
pretty
fast,
didn't I?
That could take a while,
yeah.
Right?
All right.
And of course, how good this inventory is will primarily depend on how long you live to collect the payments, which nobody knows. So let's just start with average life expectancy.
Mm-hmm.
Okay. A 60-year-old male has a life expectancy of 20 years. And a 60-year-old female has a life expectancy of 23 years. So if you live to your actuarial ages, a male would collect $30,000 for 10 years from age 70 to 80, right? That's $300,000 versus the $200,000 that they put in over 20 years. That works out to about 3% per year. Not great.
Right.
A female, about 4% a year. If you die early, your beneficiary receives any unpaid amount of the original $200,000, but you're losing big to inflation. So does it sound like a good deal to me? Not if you're going to live to actuarial age.
Right.
And that's what they're counting on, okay? What if you live longer than average? Well, then you could do a little bit better. If you lived to, say, 90, well, then you'd get a 6% return, and almost a 6% return if you're female, 6.1 male, 5.7 female. So the returns improve with longevity. But remember, there's a chance you'll get much less out of it if you have below average or average longevity. And even if you live a longer time, you've lost a lot of flexibility. And oftentimes, you'll do better with a balanced portfolio of stocks, bonds, and buffers.
Quickly, Paul, who should not buy an annuity?
Anyone who may need access to the principal of the annuity, they're purchasing.
Yeah.
Someone with average to below average longevity, someone who already has sufficient income from other recurring sources.
Paul's toll-free number, 888-972-7526, 888-972-PLAN, or you can go online to planstrong.com. Paul, thanks for coming in. We'll see you next week.
Hope everybody has a wonderful weekend.
It's the Plan Strong Financial Forum.
Plan Strong Investment Management is located at 980 Washington Street, Dedham, Mass., 02026, and can be reached at 888-972-7526. Securities and advisory services offered through Commonwealth Financial Network, member FINRA, SIPC. A registered investment advisor, Paul Parsons representative. This radio show is for informational purposes only and is not a solicitation or recommendation that any particular investor should purchase or sell any particular security. The information contained herein is obtained from sources believed to be reliable, but its accuracy and completeness are not guaranteed. Neither Commonwealth Financial Network nor your representative provides tax advice. Indexes are not managed and do not incur management fees, costs, or expenses, and cannot be invested in directly. Past performance of an index does not guarantee future results.